So you're thinking about doing a rent-to-own contract, lease-to-own, contract for deed, whatever you want to call it. Is it a good idea? Stick around. We're going to talk about it on Suits and Boots Legal Talk. Well, hey, guys. It's good to see you again. We're here with Scott Copeland. This is Scott's, I guess you'll be your third time on the podcast. So, yeah. Welcome back, man.
Well, it's good to be here.
Scott's an attorney here at Benbow Davidson & Martin. I'm Luke Martin, one of the partners there. So, it's great to see you again, buddy. We're going to talk today about lease-to-own or rent-to-own contracts in real estate. So, these things have gotten really popular because, and I guess it's because of the interest rates. As interest rates go up, people want to do this. Folks who can't qualify for a loan, and then the housing market has been such a wild ride for the last few years. Folks are really taking advantage of these things, and we've seen some problems with them, haven't we?
We have. You know, I tell people when they come in all the time, Luke, that, you know, I'm sure there's a ton of these out there that are done well. They're done exactly according to the statute. Everything goes well. We don't see those.
If it shows up
in our office, then it's probably something's gone wrong with it. So that's what we have to deal with.
I was talking to a judge the other day on the phone. This judge called, and we were talking about estate planning ideas and things that we could do. And one of the ideas that I floated to her was a trust. And she said, well, I've seen so many of those go bad. And I said, well, judge, of course you've seen so many of them go bad. You're a judge. The only things you see
are things that go
bad.
Yeah.
So oftentimes that's with us as well. The things that we see are the problems, but we do see a lot of these things giving problems.
We do. Just to make it simple, let's go back to, like, to say 2010, I think, is when the North Carolina legislature looked at these contract for deeds. And we're going to use the term rent to own or contract for deed. It's all the same concept.
Right.
Basically, let's explain that real quick. Why don't we?
Sure.
So basically, the idea is that someone has a piece of real property or a manufactured home. And there's a statute for this. It's 47H. And if you ever talk to me about one, I'll talk about 47H all the time. That controls what we have to do. But the North Carolina legislature was concerned that people may be taken advantage of by people using these rent-to-owns, and I say the purchaser being taken care of. And so they put enacted Chapter 47H, and that controls what has to be done in a contract for deed. Now, it's very specific as far as what a contract for deed is. For instance, the Chapter 47H will tell you that if you sell a piece of real property and you hold the contract while the purchaser pays you in 5 or more payments, then that's a contract for deed. It's going to fall under here. You've got to go by the statute in order to deal with problems with this.
And the way this normally comes up, right, is that you've got a tenant and you've got a landlord, and the landlord wants to sell the property and the tenant wants to buy it. And so the landlord just says something like, okay, well, I'll put this much of your rent payment toward the purchase price, or you just pay me, you rent it for this many years, and then at the end of this term, I'll just write you a deed. So it usually works out like that. Something,
right?
That's usually the plan anyway.
Yeah, there's usually an agreement. I mean, I've actually seen it with an oral agreement before, which, and that was a mess. But the question is it or is it not even a contract for deed? And we never got to court, so we never found out, but that's still out there.
Yeah.
Usually the two parties will agree and say, hey, I want to buy this piece of property. And so they sign a contract, and the Chapter 47H is very, very specific. There's 17 things that have to be in that contract for deed in order for it to actually be considered a valid document. And this is really for the protection of the purchaser, but there are things that the seller can have as well. But that's what it comes down to. And then the seller will hold the deed, and once they make that final payment, then they'll convey the property over. And I do want to say, not only does it cover real property, and this is an aside, but it also covers any manufactured home that is sold for less than $5,000.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, I'm sorry, for more than $5,000.
Sure. Yeah.
If it's less than $5,000, it wouldn't be covered. And we're not going to talk about that today, but that's just also an aside, too. So, if you are letting someone rent to own a manufactured home and sell it for $5,000 or $1, and you make 5 or more payments, then you're going to have to fall under this statute as well.
So, what happened back in 2010, and just to let folks know that most of the people taking advantage of these contract for deeds, the landlords might have multiple properties, and the idea behind the legislation is the legislature thought that, well, these wealthy landlords have multiple properties. They are in an advantaged position over someone who probably can't qualify for a loan, or they would go through a bank. who is renting a property, so they're not property owners. They're lower income, lower advantage folks, and the statute is to protect the people who are renting the properties. Whether it's a good idea or a bad idea is for another episode, but that's the situation that we find ourselves in. And so there's all these arduous things that have to be in the agreement in order for it to be binding.
That's right. And you can, it's 47H2, and I'm not going to read them all, but it's things you would expect to find in a contract. You got to have the names of both parties. You got to have the date. You got to have the sale price of the property. You got to describe the property. But some of the interesting things like I said, there's 17 things. Well, actually, there's 16 things because one of them was repealed. So there you go. If those things are not in there, and then not only that, but once it's signed and notarized, then it needs to be put recorded at the Register of Deeds.
Yep.
And so it's honestly, the ones that get to our office, I've rarely seen them recorded. They're still valid, but you know, in order to go by this, you still need to get them recorded. So yes, they're very specific about what has to happen, and that's to protect the buyers.
Well, and so as from the landlord perspective, the thing that the folks come to us and they say, hey, I don't want to sell it to them outright. And we're going to talk about doing a note and deed of trust here in a little bit or seller financing as maybe another option instead of doing it this way. But they often say, I don't want to sell it to them because I want to be able to evict them if they don't follow through with what they're supposed to do. And so the landlord thinks that by doing a lease to own or a rent to own, they have more protections. But that's actually maybe not true, is it?
Let's go back and talk a little bit, I think, about what the difference between a lease and a rent to own. And I think that'll be interesting. So everyone knows basically what a lease is. You pay someone for a set amount of time to be able to use that property, use it like it's your own. And then once it's done, you give it back or it goes month to month or you know, some kind of lease keeps going on. There's a process in North Carolina for evicting someone. And you can't just go in and never self-help. Don't go in there and just try and do stuff. But you go to the court, generally at a magistrate's court, and you say, and you file a summary ejectment, and you want to get that tenant out of there. Then you got to go in there and go through that process, and then they may or may not grant that summary ejectment. And then there's some other appeal process, things that can happen. But that's basically the way that you would get a tenant out in just a normal lease.
Sure.
And things are different, very much so, in a contract for deed. It's not that simple.
Yeah.
There's a very specific process by which you have to go through, and this is where people get tripped up because they think they can just go to small claims court, get out. If you walk into small claims court with this, I can guarantee the magistrate's going to look at this and say, I can't do anything with it. I've got to send you to district court.
That's right.
So that's what's going to happen. But the big thing I think people need to know is there is a specific, it's a notice to forfeit is what they call it in the statute. And you have to write a letter and send it to the person that may be in breach. Let's say that the person hasn't paid their payments for 3 months, or they're not providing real estate taxes or the property insurance, if that's called for in the rent-to-own contract, then you're going to write them a letter called a notice of intent to forfeit, that telling them that you are going to ask the court to void the contract is what's going to happen. So, but there are a bunch of specific things that have to be in there. And you have to give them 30 days or longer if the contract calls for that, but the statute says 30 days in order for them to cure it. What that means is anything that they have not done, if there's 5 months of payments missed, there's no taxes, if they cure those things within those 30 days, you have to keep the contract and just pick it up like it never like the breach has never happened.
Yep.
All right,
yep.
And that protects the buyers from being taken advantage of by that. But you have to go through that process. Now, when you get to the end of that process, if after 30 days they have not cured all those breaches, there could be multiple ones, then what we've done in the past when we've had these is we go straight to district court and we ask for usually three things. We ask for a determination that there's been a breach of contract. We ask for damages for whatever those breaches are. We ask for the court to give a declaratory judgment to say that this contract is now terminated.
Yep.
And then we ask for possession back to the owner of the property, the seller. Yeah.
So if you're thinking that, okay, we'll just do a lease to own or a rent to own because it's going to be easier to get out of than if we do seller financing, that's probably not the case.
That's right.
Yeah. So it creates a lot of problems. We especially run into problems where we've seen in the past where the tenant maybe abandons the property and then they're gone. And we can't find, we've had at least two cases where we've just not been able to find the tenant, and we have to give them this notice letter. And now we've got to try to find them and hire private investigators and that kind of thing. So we run into issues like that as well.
All right, it can ends up dragging on for a while. You know, trying to chase down people, and then sometimes you'll serve them the letter, and that, well, I use the term serve, give them the letter. It's not actually service. You give the letter to them, or you leave it at their house, or you send it, and then you think they're gone. Time passes, then they pop back up right at the last minute, magically. It's pretty interesting.
So. It happens all the time, all the time. So this first hit my radar maybe 6 years ago, 7 years ago or something like that. A notice went out from our malpractice carrier, actually. And our malpractice carrier was looking at the statute and sent us all an email and said, look, if you're going to do these things, these contract for deeds or these lease to owns, whatever you want to call them, if you do these things, you don't have coverage. And that was just like, whoa. Okay, so that's how much the malpractice industry looks down on these things now. Nobody likes them. Nobody wants us to do them. So we stopped doing them back then because we don't want to take on that risk. And so what we've recommended people start doing, if you've got somebody and you're thinking about entering into this type of agreement, let's just do a seller financing deal.
Yep.
And so seller financing in this type of agreement, if you're doing a contract for deed or rent to own, you're basically being the bank. So you're agreeing to be the bank. You're holding, they're buying this property. You're going to have to go through a lot of the same things that the bank has to go through anyway. And so why not just make that official and do everything exactly like the bank would do it and do a note and deed of trust? And so what happens in that case is we have a landlord and tenant come to us and say, hey, the tenant wants to buy the property. I'm gonna loan them the money, basically. So let's say the landlord wants $100,000 for the property. Now, the tenant is going to start making payments to the landlord to pay that $100,000. The landlord charges an interest rate. Now, there are minimum interest rates that we have to charge in order to comply with IRS stuff. And the IRS publishes a minimum interest rate, and it changes, I think, quarterly or monthly or something like that. But we can look that up for you. And then, so the landlord can get interest, or the seller at this point. Now it's a seller. The seller can get interest. The tenant has an absolute, or the buyer has an absolute, these are the terms of the deal. This is what we're going to do. The tenant's also building equity in the home, which is good. The tenant needs to build equity, or the buyer needs to build equity. The other thing is we have the foreclosure process. The foreclosure process in North Carolina is fairly simple. We can do most of that before the clerk. We don't have to go through this district court stuff and all those things. Sometimes we might have to, but most of the time the foreclosure stuff can be done before the clerk, and it's not very difficult if the buyer does breach. The other good thing about the note and deed of trust is it gives the buyer ownership. It gives a deed to the buyer, so the seller will do just like we would in every closing, sign a deed that goes to the buyer, and then the buyer signs what's called a deed of trust, which goes back to the seller, which is a note and deed of trust. So the note is the contract that says, hey, I'm the buyer, I agree to pay the seller this much money over this amount of time at this interest rate and this kind of payment, and it lays out all those terms. Then the deed of trust is another document that's recorded at the Register of Deeds that basically says we're conveying the title to this property to the trustee until it's paid for. So until the buyer finishes paying for it, the trustee holds title. And so if we ever need to foreclose on that property, if the buyer fails to make payments or fails to do something else they're supposed to do, the trustee can just go to the clerk and say, hey, clerk, this buyer's not doing what they're supposed to do. We need to do a foreclosure, and the clerk will. We can start that process. The other thing it does is it puts the buyer in control of the property. So it gives them ownership of the property. So now they can have their own insurance. They pay the taxes. They deal with the liability of the property. All of those things that in a contract for deed, the landlord and the tenant would kind of share. Now the seller is out of it. The landlord is out of it. He no longer has any liability for taxes, no longer has any liability for things that happen on the property. It's all covered by the buyer. And so it's just a lot more, it's a lot cleaner, it's a lot easier and a lot more simplified, I guess is the word, to use that seller financing than the contract for deed. contract for deed maybe 20 years ago, yeah, that would have been straightforward, really simple. But now with the new statutes and the way things are, it's just a lot easier to go the seller financing route.
Right. I will say this as well. I certainly, and we talk about this in the office all the time, but certainly would prefer the note and the deed of trust. We think that that's simpler. It protects both parties, and it allows for any problems to be solved in a simpler manner than a deed for trust. However, sometimes people find themselves in a situation where they just really want to do a deed of trust. So if you do have questions about those, please call us. I mean, we have thoughts. We've had obviously experience dealing with these. We see how they work out. And like we said earlier, we see the problems, so we see some of the crazy stuff that happens with factual situations around these. But there is a way out. It just has to go through the statutes. So if you're patient, you can get it done. But with a note and deed of trust, it's going to be a lot faster and probably a lot cleaner.
Yeah. One of the things we've talked about from the most of the things from the contract for deed or lease to own side, we've talked a lot about the disadvantages to the landlord, but there are some disadvantages to the tenant as well. And if the tenant will do the seller financing, owner financing, like I said, they get ownership of that property. But if we do this contract for deed, the landlord technically owns the property until that deed is signed, which will be at the end of the deal. So if with a note and deed of trust, the deed is signed at the beginning of the deal, conveying the property to the buyer. But in a contract for deed scenario, the deed is signed at the end of the deal. And so during that time, that contract for deed is going to be recorded if it's done correctly. So many of these things are done on a napkin or with a handshake, and that provides almost no protection for the tenant. But even when they're done correctly, they're recorded, and that's great. But if the landlord gets a judgment against them or something happens to the landlord, the title to that property is still subject to things that might happen to the landlord, and it's still a risk for the buyer. Even with all the protections the statute provides, the tenant still takes that property with some risk.
Yeah, they do. The law looks at these interestingly. So I've read some case law on this. During the period of a contract for deed or a lease to own, the person that's selling the property, the seller, they have what's called legal title because they still have the deeds shows up at the registered deeds in their name. But the person that's buying the property, they have what's called equitable title.
Right.
Yeah. So they have practical ownership.
Some interest in the property.
I don't know exactly what it is, you know. And the case law on this is really, it's not really, a lot of it's not happened since 47H was done. But that's how they would look at it in the past with these. So, that's something to consider as you're walking through these types of contracts.
Yeah, whether you're on the landlord side or the tenant side, it's a lot cleaner and a lot better to do the note and deed of trust route. And those are things that we can help you with. So all of that sounds super complicated, but it's really when you get it down into your individual deal. And Colin and I talked about this last week. So much of this stuff that we talk about, we have to talk so generally that it seems like we're covering this huge breadth of information, when in fact your specific interest or your specific deal probably won't be so much information. It's going to be, we're going to have a specific purchase price, a specific property, interest rate, payment plan, all of that stuff. It's super easy to come up with, and it's pretty simple to get it written down and get it done, but it just needs to be done right, and it needs to be done by someone who knows what they're doing. You don't want to do this on a napkin. You don't want to do this on a piece of notebook paper. Right. Come to see an attorney. We talk about this over and over and over again, but it's so much less expensive to get us involved on the front side than it is to get us involved on the back side when things have really gone off the rails. I mean, all these contract for deeds that you've worked on, almost all of them have been done just kind of without attorneys involved, right?
Yes, I've not seen one yet that an attorney was involved on the front end.
Yeah.
Like I said, one I've seen that was oral. The other two are just written contracts. And you look at them and go, yeah, that probably doesn't really, have all the information it should have had. And none of, I've not seen one yet that's been recorded that's had a problem, you know?
Yeah.
So I did want to say something you said. I think Colin dealt with this. I remember him telling me about a case he had where there was a rent to own, and then right as the last payment was getting ready to happen, right before that, the seller passed away.
Oh, wow.
And so had they done a note and a deed of trust, that would have not been near the issue. And now they had to deal with the estate to try and get the estate to go ahead and convey over the property. So everything was fine as far, that one worked out well as far as practically. But then you had the issue of the owner passing away right before the final payment.
Yeah, and if you have a note and deed of trust, then the only difference would be now instead of paying the owner or the seller, you're just going to pay his estate.
That's right.
And it's really seamless to do that. And that's one of the questions that we get from folks is, hey, if we do this seller financing deal, what happens if I die? Because I want my daughter or my son or my family to continue to get these payments. And that's exactly what the note would say. So it would say that it's binding on heirs and assigns, basically meaning that if something happens to you, that payment keeps getting made and it keeps getting made to whoever is in charge of your estate. The other thing that may happen is you could actually sell that note in a lot of cases. So there's all kinds of things that you can do, and it's really neat to see the different options that are out there available with the owner financing and seller financing. So that might be something that's really attractive, because in this day and age, we're seeing interest rates, gosh, the lowest that we've seen lately is maybe 6, but it's nothing to see 8 or 9, especially if you're talking about raw land with no improvements. Then it's very common to see 8%, 9% these days, and man, that hurts.
It does, and it doesn't look like it's going to be changing in the near future.
Yeah, you know,
we'll see.
We've seen some a little tweak, maybe down just a little bit this year, but I don't think it's come down like folks were expecting.
Right.
It's kind of stayed up there a little bit. So maybe this is an option that's attractive to you. If you're listening to this, you're thinking about buying property, look at the owner financing route. And that's something that we can help you with. And maybe you're looking at selling property. And if you can stand to wait and not get all your money at one time, and often there's some tax benefits to not taking all the money at one time. If you have to pay capital gains tax when you sell your property, which typically doesn't apply if it's a primary residence, but if it's not a primary residence and it's something you're wanting to sell, then it might be advantageous to you to do this owner financing stuff. So, you know, it's something to think about, and it would help you with finding buyers and things like that. If you want to talk to us about it, give us a call. Make sure to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, our Facebook page. Keep up with these podcasts. We're going to be releasing these things all the time, as you guys have seen. And it's already, we had a lady call us from Pennsylvania yesterday saying that she had seen our podcast and wanted to just talk about some estate administration stuff. And this has been really, really helpful to folks. And it's so nice to talk to people on the phone and say, hey, you know, this question you've got, we actually just did a podcast on that. So go check it out. So share these things, because it's really helpful to folks to know what's going on, to be able to see this and to get their questions answered. And hopefully they figure out that we're not as scary as we seem.
Yeah, we're just attorneys. As a former boss of mine said, I'm just a country lawyer.
I'm just a country lawyer.
So you can call me Scott, and I'm going to do work. You don't have to call me Attorney Copeland or anything like that.
We're not
formal. We try to do our best to help people out.
Every time I get a letter from attorneys every now and then, and it'll have Luke Martin Esquire on there, and I'm thinking, oh boy.
Who's that guy?
Where's this guy? So, yeah. Guys, we really appreciate you guys for watching, and y'all take care. Give us a call. We're happy to help. We're here to help anytime. Thank you so much.
The information contained in this video and audio recording is general in nature and should not be relied upon in making legal decisions. Every situation is different, and you should consult with your attorney before making any legal decisions.